And it hits me, oh my gosh, this is that triangle.
You know, there's explanation for everything that occurred in the Rendlesham Forest incident that doesn't involve aliens at all.
It was completely silent. It comes right over our heads.
He saw a classic flying saucer, really, standing in the clearing.
He turned over to my father and held his hand, and he looked in his eyes and he said, "We're not alone."
Welcome to Podcast UFO for our live show. We're live every Wednesday at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the Dark Matter Radio Network. Please remember to visit the website podcastufo.com for past episodes, blogs, and forums. During the show, feel free to participate live in our chat room. And don't forget to like us on our very active Facebook page.
Hello, everyone. This is Martin Willis, your host, and we have Linda Zimmerman, who I met out in Phoenix. She's going to be on for both hours. I'm really excited to talk to her, and you will enjoy her. She's a great speaker. And don't forget, we have some T-shirts on our website that nobody likes, but you can order them for, you know, I'm probably going to cut the price. So anyone, just throw me something. I'll send you a T-shirt. How's that? Well, maybe not anything. But anyway, I would like to thank everyone for their support. If you haven't subscribed and you want to hear a second hour of the podcast, go to getjoyride.com and /podcastUFO. The link's right on our website. And subscribers pay $1 a month or more to access the full two-hour show. And if you're having any trouble in any way, just email me at martin@podcastufo.com. And every listener, whether you support or not, is very much appreciated. Now, I want to say that we lost Jerry Pippin. He passed away a few days ago, or maybe even yesterday. I'm not sure. Michael Lauk, who used to be the newscaster on the show, was a big fan of Jerry's. And Jerry, you will be missed. I understand he ran a great show. So what's going on with the news this week?
Well, I've got a couple of things. I think that your listeners probably haven't heard of that are a little bit – well, this one's a little bit older news, but I don't think a lot of people know about it. And it really kind of – we got more detail at the UFO Congress is Thomas Reed and his case. Have you ever had Tom Reed on the show?
I believe he's going to be on next week. And, okay. Yeah, he was texting me all this information, all the media that was happening with this.
Yeah, so what happened is the Great Barrington Historical Society and Museum have inducted he and his family's case. Now, they believe they've been having abduction experiences since 1966. And so one of the sightings, there was a flap of sightings that was related to his case, and that was really popular, picked up by the local radio station. The case was even investigated by Blue Book and brought up in a list of many cases in a kind of back room meeting at the UN. And so it's gotten some attention. And because all of that, some of the people at the Historical Society felt that the case was so compelling that they believe it to be real. And they've decided to inducted into their historical society, and they've been out, especially the director of the historical society, saying, "I believe this case is real. Tom Reed has had a polygraph test. I've heard his story and his family story, and I think this is a real historical event, and that's why we have inducted him." Now, she does admit that not the entire board agreed. It was not unanimous. Three people were strongly opposed to putting this case in there, but that the rest of them decided to go for it, probably with some help with her enthusiasm. So yeah, the director, Debbie Opperman, made this happen. So it's kind of exciting, and it is pretty unique sort of thing. And of course, as you can imagine, Tom Reed has been very excited about it, and he talked about it when he did a presentation at the Congress.
Right. He was one of the people that was delayed a day. He was going to be live on the show for the listeners that caught that. I was telling everyone when I was going to be in Phoenix that he was going to be on the show as one of the people on the live show, and he was detained from weather issues.
Yeah, it was not the government that detained him. It was Mother Nature.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah, and unfortunately, his flight was canceled, and he couldn't get another one for 2 days. So that postponed his talk till Friday morning. He had to come in. He was a real trooper. He came in like at 2 o'clock in the morning, had some drinks because Richard Dolan was out, he said, having some drinks. So he had some drinks with Dolan and then went to bed. And he was up to be the first speaker the next morning. So he was a real trooper, and he did a great job. And that story, you can, with some pictures of him doing his talk, you can read at openminds.tv, of course.
Now, did he get some selfies of – did Richard get some selfies with him?
With Thomas Reed?
Oh, yeah.
Not that I know of.
Or was it just more of pictures of himself?
Probably. There are people who have posted pictures of him with others.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. All right. But I don't know if he's posted any with
I don't
him
think so. Yes, he did with Bob Lazar. An illegal picture.
Oh, yeah. Illegal backstage picture.
Yeah. So what else is happening?
So another one that comes from the UFO Congress. I've been focusing on writing about, you know, stories that came out of the Congress. And this one's really cool because at the Congress, John Burroughs, one of the Rendlesham Forest witnesses, and his lawyer, Pat Fresconia, who you've had on the show, I believe, they were at the conference and they released a press release. And essentially, as we've talked about, they have been pursuing, you know, getting medical disability for John Burroughs for the UFO event. He believes he has health issues that stemmed from that. Well, they finally came back with the final ruling, and they did give him his benefits. They kept his medical records classified, according to Burroughs and Fresconia. However, they did give him his benefits. So,
good for him.
Yeah, they released a press release saying this, and the title of the press release was U.S. Government's De Facto Acknowledgement of the Existence of UFOs. So they're essentially saying because the government acknowledged he got hurt in the line of duty, they are thus acknowledging that it was a UFO that had this effect on him, and so by de facto, they are acknowledging that UFOs exist. So that's what they're saying. So kind of interesting. And, of course, it was McCain's office, Senator John McCain's office they worked with to get these files released and get him his disability. So we've covered this. Linda Moulton Howe has covered this. I know a few others. Billy Cox, I know, wrote about it. However, it finally did break the mainstream yesterday as well, where – the Daily Mirror in the UK covered this. I've sent my story around to various media, so I hope other media cover this as well. But, yeah, I think it's a very interesting story, especially given that, you know, we've talked about this, where in this Condyne report from the UK Defense Intelligence, they speculated that these guys might have been affected by what they called UAP, another term for UFO radiation. So I think it's a really interesting case that has some legs.
I do too. One of my, I don't want to say favorite cases, but I think one of the most profound cases of them all out there is, I personally think Rendlesham Forest ranks about second.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Roswell, I know people get tired of hearing the word Roswell, but that case to me is probably the top
mm-hmm.
documented case. Casting some type of judgment. Am I feeling that?
No, I'm thinking about it. I think I would probably agree, just because there's been so many witnesses to Roswell. Of course, Nick Pope, I think, would disagree. But, of course, he's a British gentleman. So, yeah, I think you're right. I think most people would agree with you. It's a very important case.
It is. So what's the last one?
The last one is a MUFON story. This is kind of interesting. Some interesting photographs submitted by a witness in Philadelphia. So the other day, February 26th, he says at 7:38 p.m., he was driving and he saw all of these lights and they were moving around strangely. Swirling is a term that he used. And at first he thought there were reflections from inside his car. And then he realized after a while that they weren't. So he got out of his car, took some pictures and video, and submitted those. And it is interesting. I mean, if I didn't know better, I would say, well, it could be balloons or Chinese lanterns, which it possibly could be just given the pictures. But if he's correct and they were swirling and moving around in the manner he says they were, they're pretty odd in that the formations fairly different from one picture to the next. He did not submit the video because he said it was too poor. It was he just really couldn't get much on the video. But the pictures are pretty compelling. So everybody should take a look and see what they think.
Excellent. So that will be through our show notes on podcastufo.com, and you'll be able to see that. And also, getting back to Jerry Pippin, I just wanted to say that we will have a link on our show notes as well that will bring you to his website where you can actually leave a condolence note on that for his family.
Yeah, well, he'll be missed. I've known him for years, and he was a great guy, a very nice guy, a lot of fun to see him. I would usually see him in Roswell, so I'm definitely going to miss him.
Yeah, yeah, I heard nothing but good about him. Well, all right, Alejandro, thanks a lot, and we'll be talking to you next week.
All right, talk to you next week, buddy.
All right, so hang in for the music break, and we'll be right back with Linda Zimmerman. It was a pleasure meeting you, Linda, out in Phoenix, and you were on our podcast just for a couple of minutes, and I said I'd have you on, and here you are. So,
yeah, it was great. I had a wonderful time out in Arizona there. They really do an incredible job with that whole conference. It for us, it ran very smoothly, I'm sure. I'm sure not so much for them. I'm sure they encounter a lot of problems, but they really pull it off and throw a fantastic event.
I thought so, too, and I've been involved in a lot of events over the years, different types of events, but it's not easy at all. And one little thing, you know, one little thing changes, like, for instance, Tom Reed, his flight canceled, and it kind of puts a chink in the armor, and you have to figure out what to do. And luckily, you came around and took his spot. And it all seemed to work out.
Yeah.
Good thing you were ready.
Well, it was funny because we were delayed getting in on Tuesday. And when we finally get there, the first thing, you know, person I see is Alejandro, who says, "Can you fill in first thing in the morning?" I'm like a little shell-shocked, but I said, "Sure, what the heck? If I'm not ready then, I wasn't going to be ready in another day." So yeah. I was happy to fill in. It worked out perfectly.
Now, this first hour, we're going to talk – well, first of all, we're going to be talking about your book, which is called UFOs Over Hudson Valley. Do I have that right?
Hudson Valley UFOs, and the first one was In the Night Sky, which is also about Hudson Valley UFOs.
I'm sorry I messed that up. This is live radio.
No problem.
But anyway, the second hour, we're going to be focusing a little bit more on the Triangle UFOs and also Pine Bush.
Right.
Right. So let's talk about your book. And before we do that, though, I would like to find out, it's always an interesting story how people have a fascination, how they get started in the topic of UFOs. So I'm going to ask you, how did that happen with you?
Well, I grew up in the Hudson Valley, and just about everyone I know had sightings. And I had two that were very interesting that I certainly couldn't explain, and I actually began my career as a research scientist for a medical diagnostics company I had the desire to write, so I started writing about science and history and some paranormal things. And the writing about UFOs really only occurred a few years ago when I would give a lecture somewhere in the Hudson Valley and people would just start telling me their UFO stories. And I had no idea how widespread this phenomenon really was. So that's what it came to me. It wasn't anything I had, you know, sat down one day and said, I think I'll start researching this.
Okay, well, let's, before we move on and talk about the gist of this whole thing, can you explain to us, you said you had two sightings, and can you tell us about them?
Sure. I'll start with the second one first. It's easier. The Hudson Valley Boomerang, the triangle-shaped or V-shaped craft, a friend and I went out to a friend's house one night. We were driving back in the town of Washingtonville, and she said, what are those lights? And I looked over, and perfect V-shape, round, soft white lights. And I describe them as soft because it's unlike any kind of other aircraft light I have ever seen. Absolutely silent, smooth, gliding motion of this craft, and it was enormous, and it just slowly moved across the sky and out of sight.
Wow, so that's a pretty good one.
Yeah, that was pretty good one. The first one was better. I was in college in the late 70s, and a friend called and said, Linda, get outside right now. Something just passed over her house and was headed in the direction of where I was living in the town of Nanuet. So I was studying for an organic chemistry test, I recalled. I had my fuzzy red bathrobe on, and I just ran right out the door. And sure enough, there were three lights again, soft, whitish yellow, flying in, you know, a little V shape, just the three of them. Again, silent, gliding. My boyfriend and his friend were over. We all jumped in the car. I'm still in my bathrobe. And we took off after these lights. And they, after a short distance, they separated. One went east, one went north, one went south. So they were ready to give up. But I had remembered seeing in an old Frank Edwards book, I think it might have been Flying Saucers Serious Business, he had a picture of a UFO over a local state park. So I said, you know what? Let's just drive up to that park. It was about 20 minutes away. And we're sitting by a lake in the middle of the woods waiting and waiting. I'm about to give up. And all of a sudden, here come the three lights from the east, the north, and the south. They come together. And we thought they were going to collide. They come together in this blinding blue flash, and as one blue object lowers to the top of this nearby mountain, and you could see this pulsating blue light through the trees. Well, at this point, the state trooper shows up and wants to know what a girl in a black bathrobe is doing in a car with two guys. So I realized I was in a precarious situation as it was, and I talking about UFOs wasn't going to be much better, but I briefly described what we saw, and I said, just turn around and look. And he turns around, and he sees this light, this bizarre blue light pulsing, and, I mean, his entire expression changed like he had seen a ghost, and he said, get out of here right away.
Wow.
So we took off. He actually passed us taking off down the road.
That's comforting.
Yes. When state troopers are blowing by you. And it was a good thing he showed up, I guess, because my inclination, bathrobe and all, was to run on into the woods and see what this thing was, which probably wouldn't have been the most the best course of action I could have taken.
Probably would have joined Travis Walton up there or something.
Could have, or running around the woods in the dark just from a safety standpoint isn't too smart either. But, yeah, I'm very curious, but it wasn't ideal circumstances for hiking up there.
Yeah. If you're listening live on the Dark Matter Radio Network, you can jump over to podcastufo.com, and right on the sidebar, there's a chat room. You can join that, just two clicks, and you can ask our guest a question or two or communicate with other people in the chat room. Okay, so that is an amazing sighting. Now, you mentioned that you had read that book, so you did have some type of interest in UFOs, it appears.
Yes, as a kid, I loved UFOs and watched everything I could on television and read every book I could find. And again, growing up in the Hudson Valley, everybody had sightings. It wasn't an uncommon thing, and it had been, you know, at least the generation before me had been having them. And, you know, my generation was still having them. And then going into the 80s with the triangles, which, you know, we'll be talking about in the second hour. But it wasn't an uncommon thing. So nobody, you know, had a great explanation as to what we were seeing. But we all knew there were strange craft in the sky.
Now, I'd like you to go back and start talking about as far back as you researched and what you found, sort of, you know, moving forward. But had you heard a lot of, I think I've heard of a lot of explanations or debunking of what people were seeing?
Well, the big excuse, official excuse for the triangles at least, were formations of ultralight planes, which is, you know, absurd because they're noisy. It's illegal to fly at night. It's very difficult to stay in formation. So that was ridiculous. But of course, the earlier sightings, the usual, the planet Venus, weather balloons, meteors, things like that. The typical Blue Book excuses. Mm-hmm. For what everyone was seeing.
Now, I want to ask you before we move on to what to your book and your research and everything. When you had those two sightings, what was the most profound part of what hit you the hardest on what you saw and witnessed?
Well, that's a good question. Nobody's ever asked me that. I'm getting goosebumps now because when, you know, you doubt what you're seeing. I was going to school to be a chemist, and I'm trying to be rational about it. But when those three lights came together as one, there was just nothing I knew in this, you know, in my textbooks that could explain what I was just seeing. Hmm. And that blue glow, I can still vividly see it. You just knew you were seeing something otherworldly. That's and it was scary. It was exhilarating. It was something like you were part of something special.
Right. Now, did you ever speak to the officer again?
No, I don't know who it was. He might still be driving. I don't know. But if he's out there listening, I would love to hear from him again.
And how about the people that were with you in the car?
I spoke to my boyfriend at the time when I was writing the book, and I wanted to get his recollection of it. And I said, before I tell you my recollection, he described the same exact thing. So I said, okay, we're on the same page. And he said the same thing. He was saying the softness of those lights, the silence of the motion. It just gave you a chill up your spine.
Well, yeah, that's amazing. And the part that when they were silent, that's another part that's what baffled me in my own sighting. I just kept waiting for a noise.
Right. It's like something's wrong here. It's like watching the TV with the sound off. You're like, well, something's not right. I should be hearing this. Because it wasn't that far away. And even when the three objects came together, we should have heard something. And there was nothing.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's go back all the way back to the beginning of the research that you did. And, you know, the first sightings that people were talking about, or were they in newspapers? How did you do that research?
I sat down at a microfiche machine and started going through old newspapers and looking for anything that had something to do with aviation or, you know, strange sightings in the sky. And I actually came across a series of articles way back in 1909 that were talking about mysterious airships. And I know in the 1897, there were the mysterious airships in California, Texas, other locations. But this was the first I was hearing about them in the New York area, New England. And they began in the Hudson Valley around July of 1909. Now, these were objects only seen at night, and no planes were flying at night yet at that point. They had lights. They could hover. They could move very quickly. And they were seen for hours at a time. So I did my aviation research and found out we had no aircraft that could do that. And the sightings actually spread to New England. One night it was seen from New York to Boston. Another night, the town of Worcester, Massachusetts, was seeing them for hours. And this continued through at least December of that year.
And what were people speculating, since it was so early in the game there? What were they coming up with, what they were seeing?
Well, that's the interesting thing. No one was panicking. No one thought they were invaders from Mars. They thought that either the Wright brothers or Thomas Edison had invented some new aircraft that could fly at night. And they were honestly expecting, was saying in the articles that we expect any day now to have this amazing craft revealed. And they waited and they waited and nothing was ever revealed. Critics now say it was mass hysteria. Well, hysterical about what? They thought it was a man-made aircraft. Go ahead.
Well, they weren't flying at night in early aviation.
No one had yet flown at night. I think it wasn't until 1910 in South America that a plane actually flew at night. But no one knew that at the time. They thought it was some secret inventor who was about to reveal it and make his fortune, because there was a fortune to be made with aircraft. The Wright brothers sold this little stick and fabric plane to the Army for $35,000.
So that was what a huge amount of money then.
Huge. What would somebody who could develop something that could hover and fly quickly at night, he would have made, I don't know, hundreds of thousands, millions.
Absolutely. So there were the airships, there were dirigibles. Did any of that was, I'm just trying to think when they were around then, toward the beginning of the century.
Right. Yes, I did my dirigible research as well. And, of course, the Zeppelins in Germany could stay for 31 hours. They could stay in the air. But there were no Zeppelins in the U.S. in 1909. And the U.S. Army had something called the SC-1, which was really embarrassing. It was like a big balloon with a framework that people sat in hanging below the balloon. It could only go 20 miles an hour top speed and could only stay in the air for 2 hours. And that was our state-of-the-art dirigible. So clearly, 4 hours and something going at very fast speed does not describe any of the characteristics of anything that of the technology we had at the time.
Now, when they were witnessing this, were you able to come up with a number of witnesses approximately?
Well, I would say hundreds in the Hudson Valley. But when it moved up into New England, especially the Worcester sighting, I would have to say that had to be in the thousands. And also, I would say it had to have been in the thousands when it was being seen over New York City as well. So, you know, it wasn't saying how many people were out, but just the scope of the, given the population densities in these area and the scope of the activity over, we're talking July to December at least, that's a lot of people.
And so where did it progress from there? You said this was the first part of the 1900s.
In 1909.
And if we could kind of go in order of the sightings. I mean, everyone always talks about, you know, no sightings ever happened before Roswell. And there's clearly something going on here. You know, there's talk about, I think they're called ghost ships. Mm-hmm. And, you know, all different types of things people were seeing. But so go ahead and continue on, if you would, with what was happening after the 1909 time period.
Just a couple of days ago, I found another article from Kingston, New York, which is in the Hudson Valley, that talked about a very large object that looked like a box kite. That's how they described it. So it was rectangular, that hung in the air motionless for hours. Which that was the only, was a short description. No one had any idea what it was. And again, what did we have in 1912 that looked like a huge box that could sit motionless in the air for hours? There are some World War One era things, but of course then we are getting into aviation. So those, you know, those are a little harder to say that they were something other. But then in the 1920s, Bud Hopkins actually worked on a case interviewing a woman who had classic abduction phenomenon. She was outside playing. She saw this bright, shiny craft. She said it was like she was rooted to the spot. Time stopped. Everything froze. And she saw these small beings. And then she kind of lost track of time, and they took off. She gets home, and her mother is scolding her. Why had she been gone so long? And to her, it had only been minutes. And she developed phobias after that about going to the doctor or getting sick or getting examined. And so, you know, everything we kind of describe as the classic abduction case and the post-abduction trauma seemed already to be present with this woman in the 1920s.
Wow. Hey, did you ever meet Bud?
No, unfortunately, I didn't have the pleasure.
Yeah, someone was asking that on our message board. Okay, so moving along, so that was the 1920s. I mean, does this make sense to talk about this as time goes on, or would you like to?
No, that's fine, because I also interviewed a woman in her 80s who started having her abduction experiences in 1937. And this is a very bizarre case. She started seeing these short, very white figures with large eyes. And both her and her future husband, who was also having these experiences, they lived in the same apartment building as children, and they were both experiencing things then. They go on to get married in the 50s, have children who start having abduction experiences. The grandchildren are now also having them. It's quite a chilling, eye-opening case that goes all the way back to the 1930s. Again, way before Roswell. No one was talking about short figures with huge eyes, you know, abducting you that I know of so much in the 30s.
No. Not really at all.
No.
Yeah. That is something. It would be amazing if someone could, you know, continue, like, you know, Kathleen Martin is doing research, and there are a lot of other people doing research with abductees that, and I know Bud did an amazing job and other people as well. But I'm just wondering if the commonalities of that time were the same as they are now.
As far as I know, there was, you know, the classic missing time, mm-hmm. you know, the description of the figures as well. The multi-generational, which I'm finding a lot in the Hudson Valley, it all seemed to, all the elements seemed to be there. She didn't describe physical effects so much, but it's a very early start, and I have to add, it is still going on this past year. She saw these figures once again. So we're talking from 1937, I don't know if anybody has a calculator, to 2015. What span of time is that? That's quite a long time.
Yeah. I can never, ever do math under pressure. I consider this pressure. So, but anyway... Was she actually seeing a white figure with big eyes as well?
Two short white. She's very, very white, biggish heads, huge eyes, and they're the same ones she saw in the 40s, in the 50s, the 60s, all the way up to the present. And now, her husband was seeing them as well.
Now, a question on the message board. When did she – this is kind of key to this whole thing, I think. It makes sense to be – is when did she start telling the story?
Well, I don't know how many people – she didn't really talk too much about. She told her father in the 30s, and he just told her she was dreaming. I guess she was discussing it in the 50s a lot when her whole family was starting to have experiences. So I would love to be able to say she documented it in the 30s and 40s, but I can only take her word for it that, you know, it really occurred.
Yeah, you know, you just have to look at it from how someone trying to debunk it, you always have to kind of approach things. Well, what will someone say? And they'll say, oh, yeah, they heard Bud Hopkins talking about interviewing people about this, and that's why, you know, she started. She wanted, you know what I mean? You always have to,
right?
You always have to think of, and if you could find a documented case where someone actually documented it, you know, way before, say the Betty Hill case, mm-hmm. You know, all the better for that. And
right. The other thing is, she didn't talk to newspapers or try to gain from that. She never publicly came out with this, never tried to profit from it. I think I was the first one outside the family that she had ever discussed this with.
Wow. And how did you gain her trust?
Well, I had first interviewed her son, and that was why I decided to start writing about these cases, because someone came up to me after a lecture and started telling me about it was her boyfriend's experiences. And it turned out that my husband knew this man back in high school. And I said, tell me about this guy. Is he, you know, did he make things up? And he says, I never heard of these, you know, I had no idea he'd been having these experiences. So I spoke to him and I said, okay, this, this guy, he has a compelling story to tell, and he has the physical marks on his body to go along with it. And when he mentioned his mother was still alive, I didn't know she was having her own experiences. I just wanted to speak to her to see what kind of boy he had been. Was he very imaginative? Was he secretive? And then as I'm speaking to her, she comes out with talking about her own experiences going back to the 30s. And, you know, what's that expression? Knock me over with a feather. I had no idea. And then come to find that the grandchildren, one of them's moved up to Vermont, and she and actually her child, so we're talking four generations now, are having experiences.
Now, when you were speaking to her, pardon me, I was distracted just for a second there. Did you say that it stopped at a certain time in her life?
No, it is still going on, and it has occurred again. She has seen these figures within the last year.
I'm talking about the elderly woman.
Yes.
Really?
Yes.
Her too? Wow.
Yes.
That's pretty amazing.
It's, yes, it's, it is quite remarkable. And, you know, the fact that whatever this is still going on. I've got my calculator here. Let's see how many years. 78 years this has been going on with her.
That was right on the tip of my tongue.
I know.
Yeah.
I'm just confirming what you were about to say.
That's right. Yeah. So, you know, the abductions are always fascinating and kind of puzzling, and you know, there's a lot of controversy about them. Mm-hmm. Did you study both or research both abductions and the sightings at the same time?
They went hand in hand. I honestly did not expect to come across any cases like that, or you know, maybe one or two vague descriptions. And I would a very large percentage of the cases turned out to be missing time, contactees, abductees. And I'm saying to myself, what is going on here? I had no idea. You know, of course, the book Communion, Whitley Strieber's book, was based on experiences he had in the Hudson Valley. But if true, I thought that was an isolated thing to him. But I'm finding that many, many cases up and down the Hudson Valley for generations have had this very close contact. And it surprised the hell out of me, honestly. And it turned out that in the book In the Night Sky, the abduction chapter turned out to be the largest chapter in the book.
Hmm. Now, why would you speculate the Hudson Valley?
I think it's been going on a very long time, so I think we can rule out the nuclear power plant we have in the Air Force Base, and you know, it was all predating that. The only thing I can think of is a lot of the sightings take place in and around water, and of course we have the Hudson River and, mm-hmm. and many, many lakes and reservoirs. And also, specifically during the Triangle sightings, a lot of them were seen in an area of the Hudson Valley that had old iron mines, minerals, and not just regular iron, but very pure, high concentrations of magnetite. Hmm. So whether or not there's something about the Earth's natural electromagnetic field in these areas that they can somehow utilize. Obviously, pure science fiction and speculation on my part, but mm-hmm. why otherwise they have been drawn here, I don't know.
That's something. Now, let's see, we have a question up there. Someone wanted to know if aliens or whoever they were communicating with this elderly lady who had contact most of her life. Were they communicating anything with her?
She doesn't really recall any kind of communication that they were ever actually speaking with her or giving her messages. However, her son said that when he was very little and they started coming in his room, he said he would see these projections. They almost sound like holographic images in his room. He said he'd see formulas and geometric shapes, and you know, he didn't quite know what it all meant, but it did seem as though they were somehow trying to communicate or teach him something. But other than that, it wasn't any clear messages that they were getting.
Now, do you happen to know, in this particular family, were there any daylight abductions, or was this always when they were, like, during sleeping hours?
Oh, broad daylight in the 1940s, early 1940s. She was walking home from a friend's house, and the next thing she knew, it was hours later. And it was, you know, a sunny afternoon. And other daylight occurrences had happened to several of them. For the most part, I think a lot of them happened at night, but not all.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, it seems to me that if this was happening to me, as crazy as it would sound, I would think I would end up at a police department saying, "You guys got to help me." You know, you never hear about anyone like contacting the police and saying, "This is happening to me. I need help." Have you?
Well,
you've heard of something.
No, not really, because I mean, you get ridiculed if you say you see a light in the sky. They would probably have locked you up if you went in and said that aliens just abducted you. For the most part, what the people I've interviewed, they've maybe told a few family members and very close friends, and that's it. There's a stigma, obviously, attached to it, and most people, they don't want to go there. They don't want to make it any worse for themselves.
Mm-hmm. I can understand that. I guess you're kind of like baffled by the whole thing. You know, I mean, that's what everybody kind of seems to say. Like, it's sort of almost like a dream, but not, you know. I mean, you hear that type of thing all the time.
Right, right. Either they don't remember anything or it just seems like a dream. I am baffled, but, you know, from my chemist perspective, the story that this family has told me seems like one big science project. This is the way you would set up an experiment following generations of a family.
Absolutely. I've wondered about that. You know, you hear about the generations and why would they be doing that? You know, maybe it is some type of experiment. What type of markings? Did you say there were markings?
Yes. On the son that I first interviewed, he has three triangular indentations on the back of his neck. He had a cauterized scoop mark that left a scar on his thigh.
You hear about the scoop marks.
Yes.
Hmm.
Yeah, he had a couple of hours that he'd seen an egg-shaped lighted craft, and the next thing he knew, it was 2 hours later. And the next day, he was having nosebleeds, and his thigh hurt, and he found this scoop mark, but he said it wasn't bleeding. It had actually been cauterized, but he could put his finger into the indentation. And he was very sick for like a week afterwards. His children, one morning, he went to kiss them goodbye as they were in bed. He used to leave for work very early. And all three of his children were in bed with blood on the pillow and blood all over their face. All three of them had nosebleeds that night.
Oh.
What are the chances?
Right. Wow. a question up on the message board. The son who had seen the holographic equations, does he now have any enhanced abilities like math or anything like that? Are you aware of that?
Not mathematically. I asked him that. Musically, he's been a musician his whole life. Whether that had anything to do with it, I don't know. Maybe they were trying to get him into math. It's all so bizarre. You're trying to make a rational picture out of something that you only have a handful of pieces for.
Right, right. Well, that's an amazing family story right there.
It is. It's one of many in the Hudson Valley.
Uh-huh. Do you want to talk about more? Or would you like to go chronologically forward from that time?
It's up to you. I certainly have more cases on that. Chronologically, we started just briefly in the 50s, the cigar-shaped, the saucer-shaped, moved into the triangles in the 80s. More recently, we're seeing rectangles. So lots of sightings in the 50s, 60s, 70s, an enormous amount in the 80s and 90s. Not so much in the last decade, but it does seem to be picking up. So that's kind of the chronology of it. But throughout all of that, the abductions seem to continue. A story I told at the conference, which was rather chilling, was a little girl was playing in her sandbox, and this was in the early 70s, and she looks up at the window where her mother was washing dishes or working in the kitchen. She said all of a sudden her mother was not moving, like frozen in place, and the birds stopped singing, and that whole frozen in time experience. And the next thing she knows, she's on some sort of examination table, and there's some sort of beings there, and she didn't see them speak, but in her head, she heard, "We can't keep her. We have to send her back. She's damaged." And the next thing she knows, she's back in the sandbox, and her mother's moving again, and the birds are singing again, and everything is okay. And she didn't know at the time, didn't learn until later on when she was older, that as a baby, she had something wrong, that she needed to have a stent, a drain, placed in her head, in her brain. So perhaps in that regard, she was damaged and not useful for whatever it is they were trying to do. And that certainly gave me the goosebumps hearing her story.
Yes, I remember you saying that. Yeah, that was something else.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you said back in the 50s, 1952 was a banner year. Was there a lot of sightings in the Hudson Valley during that year? Are you aware of?
Not aware of 52 specifically. I know of quite a few in 53. Of cigar-shaped objects, a lot of the classic saucer, flying saucer-shaped, round disc-shaped objects were in the 50s as well. And a lot of people who reported them were not reporting them because they thought they were aliens. They were reporting them because they were afraid they were Russians, Russian bombs or Russian spy planes. So there was that Cold War paranoia that obviously had people out and watching and reporting objects then.
Right, right. It's kind of funny how, like, the crafts seem to evolve that people see. The cigar shape, the
right.
saucer, the triangle.
And as I said, we seem to be graduating now into the rectangle. Why that is, I couldn't tell you, but there does seem to be a change in craft.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned earlier that someone mentioned something about a box shape.
Yes, as I said, just a couple of days ago when I was researching newspaper files, I came upon, they described it as looking like a giant box kite. So my interpretation of that, it was, you know, rectangular or box-shaped, and they described it as very large and absolutely motionless for hours in the sky.
Hmm.
So if it was some sort of dirigible, obviously they're not box-shaped, and they cannot remain motionless if there's any kind of wind, obviously. So I'm going to search more around that time period and see if I can find any other accounts of this.
Now, is it microfilm? Is that what you search through?
When I go to the historical societies, I search microfilm. Otherwise, there are some online newspaper archives that I search as well. Mm-hmm. But it's difficult because they weren't using the term UFO, in the early years. So I try to do search for strange lights or, object in the sky. So you're fishing, you're throwing out all these terms and seeing if you get a hit on something.
Right. Boy, so many different terms, right?
Yes. Yes.
If
anybody out there has some other suggestions, I'm open to it. Otherwise, you just sit there and go through newspaper after newspaper, and it's very time consuming.
Now we have about 3 minutes left to the top of the hour. What would you say for the earlier sightings before 1947, when you heard everything about the flying saucers? After that, mm-hmm. What would you say was the most profound sighting that was on record?
Well, I have to say this mysterious airship of 1909 was, today would be considered a major flap. I mean, mass sightings throughout the East Coast over the course of at least 6 months. I'm very impressed by the characteristics of, what people were describing, the flight characteristics. And as I say, just the sheer number of people over such a long period of time, it really is remarkable and really deserves to have further study.
Mm-hmm. Now, someone mentioned on the message board a while back, did you see if any of these were related to Pennsylvania as well?
I hadn't seen any accounts mentioning Pennsylvania, but then again, I have not been searching Pennsylvania newspapers.
Right.
Mostly New York, New England. And it really was as far north as Rochester, which is, way to the north of the state, and out to the coast, Boston, up to Maine, down to New York City. So Pennsylvania certainly could have been included in that. It's a good idea to, because I know Connecticut was included in that as well. So I should check actually New Jersey and Pennsylvania.
Yeah, there wasn't really any network of newspaper that branched out between states really to speak of. So you really have, when you're doing research in the olden times, you have to go region by region, really, don't you?
Yes, you do. And if you're lucky enough to do it online and get a hit, though actually I found one account, it was mentioned in a Kansas City newspaper. They would somehow take little bits from around the country. So you really have to do a shotgun approach and check them all. But obviously your best bet is your regional papers.
Yes. Okay. So we're ready to say goodbye to our first hour guests. So say goodbye to them.
Goodbye.
And we'll be back in hour two if you'd like to support the show. We'll be back in hour two, and we're going to be talking about the triangle UFOs. And we're also going to be talking about Pine Bush and a lot more. So if you're listening live, hang in for right after the music break. We'll be right back. So remember, you can listen to the second hour of the show by becoming a subscriber for as little as $1 a month. All that information is right on our sidebar on our website. It's basically getjoyride.com/podcastUFO and as little as 23 cents a week. Well, I want to thank everyone for helping out with the show today. Alejandro Rojas for the news, our guest, Linda Zimmerman, Carrie Lloyd Whitehouse, and Bruce Rainier for our music, Peggy Shunning for managing our Facebook page, and remember to like us on Facebook for all the latest UFO news. Tom Reed will be with us next week, and you can check us out live right here on the Dark Matter Radio Network and every Wednesday, 8 to 10 Eastern Standard Time. This is Martin Willis reminding you to keep your eyes to the sky, and we'll see you. We'll